Welcome, listeners. It's Valley Voices. I'm Marilyn Gleason, and we have a great half hour of public affairs coming up, so stick around. Delia Malone is an ecologist. She's the Roaring Fork Audubon Vice Chair, and she's the board chair of Colorado Wild. We've had her in the studio a few times. It's always great to talk about the wild with Delia, and that is what we're going to do today. So welcome to Valley Voices.
Thank you, Marilyn, and a Happy New Year. It's delightful to be here.
Happy New Year to you. We just had the wolf full moon. You had a celebration. We're going to be talking about wolves a little later in the half hour today. So beavers, wolves, Colorado parks and wildlife, those are the topics of the day. Let's start with beavers. We've tried to get to the beavers before, and we kind of, you know, there's always so much to talk about. But beavers are large rodents. I understand the second largest in the world. They weigh up to 100 pounds. They build dams and lodges. They're amazing constructors. And, yeah, I've had to try to pull apart a beaver dam in a ditch culvert. And you realize what really great builders they are when you do that. And Colorado Parks and Wildlife, which is the agency that looks out for our wildlife here in Colorado, they have a new plan for beavers. Tell me about the plan.
Well, they do. The good parts about the plan are that they are really focusing on implementing non-lethal coexistence conflict prevention strategies. And they're also working on a plan where folks can live trap and relocate beavers from areas where there are problems, such as golf courses, to areas that are more suitable for them on ranches or on public lands. One of the aspects that they likely will retain, but which myself and beaver advocates are not supporting, is the concept of recreational, what they call recreational harvest, in other words, recreational killing on public lands. And I think it's really critical to understand just how important beavers are in the arid West. They, in their, as you noted, Marilyn, they build these amazing dams. It's not just sticks, but they are well constructed. There's mud and there's rocks, and they are really so perfectly constructed to store water, temporarily store water, because the dams are permeable to water. And in that water storage, they're slowing down the flooding flows, and they're maintaining that stored water to be released later on during August and September when stream flows are really low. So they maintain stream flows throughout the season. They, in that water storage, a lot of the sediment that's in the water, that's in the water column drops out. So they're cleansing the water. They're storing carbon in the bottom of that pond, which helps mitigate climate warming. And so when they build ponds, those ponds are really important fish habitat for fish spawning. They're important for amphibians. The vegetation that grows around the pond edges is critical songbird habitat. And, you know, something that really was just discovered in the last, or realized, not discovered, but realized in the last 10 years or so, is how important these large beaver dam complexes are for mitigating wildfire. And we all know that in Colorado and in the arid West, with our warming climate, the fire hazard is dramatically increasing, and streams are drying, climate is warming, and beavers, cute, sweet little rodents that they are, mitigate and prevent all of these, all the while enhancing biological diversity.
Wow. That's amazing. And one more thing that I have heard about is the beaver dams also can even help recharge aquifers.
Absolutely. So what happens, of course, when the water is stored, when you look at a beaver dam, you're probably seeing maybe 20% of the water that's actually being stored. The rest of the water that's being stored is infiltrating sideways into what's called the hyperrheic zone. So, and then that water filters down into the aquifers to replenish the aquifer. So in so many ways, beavers are amazing. And why do we need to restore them? They currently occupy maybe 15 to 20% of their historic habitat. Mm. They were trapped out. They were hunted out for hats and other commodities. And I think at the time we had no clue as to just how important they are on the landscape.
Beavers were really important economically back in the 19th century, right? I mean, they were really a prized animal out here in the American West and North.
They were, and we know how many beavers likely occurred historically as compared to now. I said about 15 to 20%. Because the Hudson Bay Company, the company that took the furs and sold them primarily to Europe for hats, they kept good records. So we know how many there used to be, tens of millions, and we know approximately how many there are now.
Much of what you were talking about, I think, were what we call ecological services, correct? Mm. What is an ecological service?
It's a very utilitarian viewpoint about what wildlife does for humans. So when we talk about the services, for instance, plants, they take up carbon and they take in sunlight and water, and then they provide oxygen to us. And in that process, they clean the air and give us oxygen. That's a service. That's something that a plant does that provides us with life. In another way of looking at the value of the wild is to think about their intrinsic value. In other words, wildlife and plants have value beyond what they do for us. They have value in and of themselves. So even if they're not any good for us, if we can't think of what in the world does a bluebird do for us besides bring beauty to the world, it has intrinsic value. It has value. It doesn't think of it, oh, I'm going to do this for humans. It has value in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I believe that. And it's an interesting point because it's kind of brings up things that we talk about when we talk about wilderness, too, and protecting lands. And I have to tell you, in journalism school, I was pretty much taught that, you know, if you're writing a story about these things, you want to write it in a way that's like, that is like, what does this animal do for humans? Why should I care? And that's our very self-centered approach, I think.
Well, and it's an approach that has led to the decline and the biodiversity crisis that we are in now. When people thought about songbirds, they really didn't, you know, think of what are they doing for us? Well, we can shoot them and we can eat them. And that has gotten us to a place where if something doesn't have a value for humans, then often we feel like we can get rid of it. And so without knowing it, we have hoisted our own petard and we've gotten rid of the biological diversity that sustains the planet. And that's a very self-centered approach. If we can go beyond that and say everything, every bit of life, whether it's the lichen on a rock or whether it's the great blue heron that's making its nest in our ponderosa tree, they all have value.
Mm-hmm. And the discussion about wilderness is, should there be places where people don't go, where it's just habitat for the wild?
Absolutely. And that is at the heart of the Wilderness Act, that wilderness is preserved for its own sake, that we are just visitors there, that we don't take anything out of it, that we protect it for future generations for its own sake. And when we start looking at wilderness as a commodity, that is when we have we're enticed, we're driven to say, well, what good is it? Can't we ride our bikes there? If we can't ride our bikes there, then what good is it? If we can't recreate there by hang gliding there or flying drones there, then what good is it? It has its own inherent value.
And back to the beavers. What do you love about beavers?
Oh, gee.
What's special? What's magnetic about this animal?
What's special about beavers is that they are, boy, if you haven't held a beaver, you don't really ever realize just how warm and fuzzy they are. And they're just magnificent. If you think about, here's this rodent, very large, 50, 60 pounds. Yes, they can get bigger, but 50, 60 pounds is fairly typical. What they do and how they've evolved to live and engineer their own home, protecting, you know, the reason they build dams and their ponds is that's their mode of protection. They really are very vulnerable when they're outside of their pond, but they have their pond. They can get underwater. Cougars, which are a common predator of beavers, really don't swim too well, so that's protecting. Wolves are a common predator of beavers, and wolves have to ambush them when they're out of water. So beavers have adapted and evolved this amazing relationship with the natural world
and water,
to build their own homes. And in so doing, they create so much benefit for other wildlife.
And what's the deal with that rather unique tail?
Oh, gee. You know, they use it for all kinds of things. They use it, for instance, you know, when you tore that dam apart, it wasn't just sticks, it was mud. And they carry that mud on their tails.
No kidding.
And they slap it into that dam, and they kind of cement it all together. And, of course, they use it to slap to warn people when we're around, to warn others when we're around, and dive. So it's a very useful device.
Interesting. So this new plan for beavers has not yet been approved. There's going to be a presentation for the Board of County Commissioners here in Garfield County next week. Is that right?
There's going to be a presentation by Colorado Parks and Wildlife staff to the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission. Okay. And that will be on Wednesday. And you can Zoom in to watch those presentations. Just go to CPW Commission and then go to the meeting. The commissioners will be listening and to the staff during their presentation. They will not be yet making a decision on whether or not they approve that plan.
And this is a CPW plan, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So why are the Garfield County commissioners involved? Okay. I'm jumping topics here, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
No worries.
But there's just this presentation next week.
So I think we were going to talk about Garfield County Commission because there's this enormous development project in Garfield County.
That's right. And there's a meeting tonight.
There is.
We can take a moment to just mention that. Didn't get it on the newscast this morning, but the Cattle Creek Coalition is meeting tonight at the 3rd Street Center to talk about this very large development between the Roaring Fork River and Highway 82 in the Cattle Creek area, something like 1,500 houses, some affordable units, and a whole lot of building in sort of a big open area right now. What's that area good for right now, Delia?
Well, so to in a nutshell, this proposed development would essentially be a new city on the banks of the Roaring Fork. Right now, this piece of property, a couple 300 acres or so, has been through a lot of iterations over the last 30, 40 years. It was a ranch, then it was sold, it was scraped off for a proposed development, and it switched hands numerous times. Over that time period, the landscape has self-restored, and now we see a big sage meadow. And during winter, it's one of the last places in the Lower Roaring Fork that provides habitat for overwintering elk. And as most folks know, winter is the hardest time for elk. It's the time where elk are basically they're just hanging on, and they need these quiet places away from humans to just be quiet. They're basically every day during winter, because they can't possibly take in enough vegetation, they're going through a slow starvation. So they need these places that are refugia from human disturbance to survive the winter. And this proposed development would basically cover that habitat that elk are now using with homes.
Okay. We're talking to Delia Malone. She's the vice chair of Roaring Fork Audubon, board chair of Colorado Wild, and on to wolves. Colorado's wolf reintroduction seems to be taking up actually a lot of space on the national radar right now. So that's interesting. We'll talk about that. But maybe first we should just review the timeline of wolf reintroduction in Colorado. It was passed by voters very narrowly a few years ago, and the first reintroduction happened in January of 2023, I think, if I'm correct.
December of 2023.
Okay.
At the end, very end of December, so it was the 23-24 year. So it was at the very end of December
right.
of 23. Those wolves, there were 10 of them. They were reintroduced to Colorado. They were captured in Oregon, and they were brought to Colorado and reintroduced here.
And then there was another round.
The next reintroduction,
year.
The 24 reintroduction, was 15 wolves, and those wolves came from British Columbia. And we have now... we have probably 20 wolves in Colorado. Those 20 wolves are in four packs. One of those packs is here in the Roaring Fork watershed, the Copper Creek pack. There's probably also three litters of pups, and one of those litters is here in the Roaring Fork watershed with the Copper Creek family.
So these are new litters.
These are new
year.
Litters. These
oh,
are new
right.
litters, yeah.
So 25 wolves originally introduced, and 10 of those were
Actually, 11 of them have died.
Mm-hmm.
Eight of those deaths were due to humans, and three of those deaths were, well, two of those deaths were wolf-on-wolf fighting, due to fighting, and one death was due to a mountain lion.
Okay, and what were the human-caused?
Oh, gee. So there was one wolf that was... accidentally caught in a trap that was meant for a coyote, and that wolf, so that killed that wolf. There was another wolf that was hit by a car up in the Northwest. There were three wolves that made the big mistake of crossing the Wyoming border and were killed by humans.
Because they're not protected in Wyoming?
In Wyoming, over 85% of the state, so basically all of the state except for the corner up by Yellowstone, wolves can be killed as many as you want, any time of day, any time of the year, by any means. You can trap them, you can snare them, you can run them over with snowmobiles, you can shoot them. So it's dangerous territory for wolves. Where were we? We were at...
The three.
I lost count.
Cars.
And then two wolves were killed by CPW staff, one for predating livestock. Well, both for predating livestock. One here in the Roaring Fork Valley. That was one of the Copper Creek juveniles that was shot and killed by CPW staff. And another wolf... also, a Rio Blanco, up in Rio Blanco County. Also, one of the Copper Creek juveniles that had been left behind for dead and then managed to get all the way the heck over from Grand County looking for his family. He made it to Rio Blanco County where there were some bands of sheep that were unprotected. And I'm sure he was hungry. He was on his own. He'd been on his own for almost a year, and they sent out a sharpshooter, and they shot and presumably killed that wolf.
Never found it.
They never found it.
It's a hard story. I mean, there's a lot of death in this story.
Yeah.
There was a plan to bring another 15 wolves from Canada this month. That was scuttled by the administration. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just the administration that scuttled it. Then you're getting into a very complicated story. And I forgot, one wolf, the original Copper Creek father, died. And ultimately, he died because of a gunshot wound to his leg.
And it took a while to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. So back to our scuttled reintroduction this year. In essence, what didn't happen was that we could not source the wolves from in the United States. We were going to get them from British Columbia again, and then the Trump administration stepped in and said that that was outside of the realm of the Memorandum of Understanding that U.S. Fish and Wildlife had with Colorado. What the MOU actually said was that the preferred, and that's the word in the MOU, the preferred source was one of the northern Rocky Mountain states. It did not prohibit sourcing wolves from British Columbia, but they put the kibosh on that with a lot of threats.
And why have we been having problems at times getting wolves from other states where there are wolves?
Boy, that's complicated. One of the potential sources was from various tribes. The Colville tribe was one potential source. Nez Perce tribe was another potential source on their ceded lands. But they did not want to, or they wanted to honor the Southern Ute Indian tribe, who said that they were opposed to wolf reintroductions in Colorado. Mm-hmm. So to honor that tribal wish, they chose not to give Colorado wolves from their ceded lands, even though those wolves will be killed this winter. Mm-hmm. By that tribe.
Okay. Recently, there's some new news from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, a letter that came to the CPW making certain demands. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife ready to take control of the wolves in Colorado from our own Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Tell me what's going on there, please.
Again, another complicated scenario. So, basically, Secretary Bergen wrote a letter to the Polis administration saying that Colorado had not abided by the MOU, and they wanted an explanation within 60 days, and they wanted us to justify the actions that they purport were in violation of that MOU, and if we couldn't give them a satisfactory answer, they would take over the wolf management plan.
There's a lot of documents being requested, demanded.
Yeah, and I think this has been driven, in my opinion, by the ranching industry who wants to stop any further wolf reintroductions. A lot of the myth, a lot of the unproven myth that has been purported is what Fish and Wildlife is using to say that we have not abided by the MOU. For instance, we'll go back to the Copper Creek family is, boy, at the center of this controversy. And they are, you know, have been scapegoated, like wolves have been scapegoated for centuries. So I mentioned that first wolf that was shot, and the adult Copper Creek male that was shot and was trying to feed his family at the time. The mom was in the den with pups. And we know that the wolf had started foraging in a carcass pit, an open carcass pit, a carcass pit that CPW had asked the rancher to close.
And these are carcasses of cattle.
These are carcasses that belong to the rancher that die from poison, from eating the wrong thing, from child, you know, from birth. They're not from wolf causes. These are carcasses that often die. Cattle and sheep die often from natural causes.
And it essentially trained that pack to look for that very available food.
To be clear, and this is a myth, and there's no support for this myth, that neither of those wolves that were brought from Oregon, the mom and the dad, the original adults, neither of them had prior experience to predating livestock. That is a myth. And that is one of the main myths that Fish and Wildlife is using to say that we did not abide by the MOU. So that male, he'd been shot. He had this food source of dead cows in a carcass pit. And so he learned, because of that rancher's not taking appropriate measures to cover the carcass, but he learned to predate livestock. And so that started down this road of accusing the Copper Creek family and consequently the state of Colorado of not adhering to the restrictions in the MOU.
Okay. Well, there's so much more that we could talk about with wolves because it is complicated and it is it's very emotional, I think, on all sides for everybody. But a question that I would like to ask you is, Delia, what could we learn from state places like Yellowstone and Idaho, where there really are big populations of wolves, where they've already been through the growing pains that we're going through in Colorado 20 years ago? What can we glean from their experience? What can we not have to learn all over by ourselves?
Thank you, Marilyn. That is such an important question. What we can learn, but it seems we haven't taken the lesson to heart very well, is that with non-lethal coexistence methods, we can coexist with wolves. We can have all of the benefits that wolves bring to the state, which are many, and we can also make sure that ranchers don't lose livestock. This is not an either or. So what we've learned, for instance, you know, the one of the biggest compensation costs that was paid to a rancher was paid for what are so-called livestock production losses, weight losses, and reduced conception rates. What we've learned is that with using low-stress livestock handling techniques, ranches that do that, their cows, even in the presence of wolves and grizzly bears and cougars, actually gain weight using these low-stress livestock handling methods. We can do this. What we've learned is that if ranchers want to be the stewards that they could be by using low-stress livestock handling methods, they could both improve their herd and their benefits, their monetary benefits, and we could have biodiversity restored.
To what extent have some of these non-lethal and coexistence methods been adopted? Because CPW's worked hard to get these options out there.
Another really important question. So CPW has really stepped it up. If you look at their budget, on the other hand, they've only spent the last budgetary year $90,000 on coexistence tools. They've spent $600,000 compensating ranchers for losses. I would like to see that flipped. So they've only had 19 ranches that have installed Fladry. They've only had about 90 ranches that have looked at covering up their carcass pits.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but thank you so much for joining me today and having this important conversation. I always love having you in here. We've been talking to Delia Malone. She's from Colorado Wild and Roaring Fork Audubon. And thank you so much.
Marilyn, thank you.
Look forward to the next time.